The English New Testament and the Court of Rome. Chapter 6. And Bullen appointed maid of honor to Catherine. And Bullen, who had been placed by her father at the court of France, had returned to England with Sir Thomas, then ambassador at Paris, at the time that an English army made an incursion into Normandy, 1522. It would appear that she was presented to the queen about this period, and appointed one of Catherine's maids of honor. The following year was a memorable one to her from her first sorrow. Among the young noblemen in the cardinal's household was Lord Percy, eldest son of the Earl of Northumberland. While Wolsey was closeted with the king, Percy was accustomed to resort to the queen's apartments, where he passed the time among her ladies. He soon felt a sincere passion for Anne, and the young maid of honor, who had been cold to the addresses of the gentlemen at the court of Francis, replied to the affections of the heir of Northumberland. The two young people already indulged in daydreams of a quiet, elegant, and happy life in their noble castles of the north, but such dreams were fated to be of short duration. Wolsey hated the Norfolks, and consequently the Bullens. It was to counterbalance their influence that he had been first introduced at court. He became angry, therefore, when he saw one of his household suing for the hand of the daughter and niece of his enemies. Besides, certain partisans of the clergy accused and of being friendly to the Reformation. It is generally believed that even at this period Wolsey had discovered Henry's eyes turned complacently on the young maid of honor, and that this induced him to thwart Percy's love, but this seems improbable. Of all the women in England, Anne was the one whose influence Wolsey would have had most cause to fear, and he really did fear it, and he would have been but too happy to see her married to Percy. It has been asserted that Henry prevailed on the cardinal to thwart the affection of the two young people, but in that case did he confide to Wolsey the real motive of his opposition? Did the latter entertain criminal intentions? Did he undertake to yield up to dishonor the daughter and niece of his political adversaries? This would be horrible, but it is possible, and may even be deduced from Cavendish's narrative, yet we will hope that it was not so. If it were, Anne's virtue successfully baffled the infamous plot. But be that as it may, one day when Percy was in attendance upon the cardinal, the latter rudely addressed him. "I marvel at your folly, that you should attempt to contract yourself with that girl without your father's or the king's consent. I command you to break with her." Percy burst into tears, and besought the cardinal to plead his cause. "I charge you to resort no more into her company," was Wolsey's cold reply, after which he rose up and left the room, and received an order at the same time to leave the court. Proud and bold, and ascribing her misfortune to Wolsey's hatred, she exclaimed as she quitted the palace, "I will be revenged for this insult." But she had scarcely taken up her abode in the Gothic halls of Hever Castle, when news still more distressing overwhelmed her. Percy was married to Lady Mary Talbot. She wept long and bitterly, and vowed against the young nobleman who had deserted her a contempt equal to her hatred of the cardinal, and was reserved for a more illustrious, but more unhappy fate. This event necessarily rendered her residence in this country far from attractive to Anne Boleyn. "She did not stay long in England," says Burnet, following Camden. "She served Queen Claude of France till her death, and after that she was taken into service by King Francis' sister." Anne Boleyn, lady-in-waiting to Margaret of Valois, was consoled at last. She indulged in gaieties with all the vivacity of her age, and glittered among the youngest and the fairest at all the court festivities. In Margaret's house she met the most enlightened men of the age, and her understanding and heart were developed simultaneously with the graces. She began to read, without thoroughly understanding it, the holy book in which her mistress, as Brantome informs us, found consolation and repose, and to direct a few light and passing thoughts to that mild Emmanuel, to whom Margaret addressed such beautiful verses. At last and returned definitively to England. It had been asserted that the Queen Regent, fearing that Henry after the Battle of Pavia would invade France, had sent and to London to dissuade him from it. But it was a stronger voice than hers which stopped the King of England. "Remain quiet," wrote Charles V to him. "I have the stag in my net, and we have only to think of sharing the spoils." Margaret of Valois, having married the King of Navarre at the end of January 1527, and quitted Paris and her brother's court, it is supposed that Sir Thomas Bullen, who was unwilling that his daughter should take up her abode in the Pyrenees, recalled her to England probably in the winter or spring of the same year. There is not the least evidence that she came to it earlier, says a modern author. She appeared once more at court, and the niece of the Duke of Norfolk soon eclipsed her companions. By her excellent gesture and behavior, as we learn from a contemporary unfriendly to the Boleyns, all the court was struck by the regularity of her features, the expression of her eyes, the gentleness of her manners, and the majesty of her carriage. She was a beautiful creature, says an old historian, well-proportioned, courteous, amiable, very agreeable, and a skillful musician. While entertainments were following close upon each other at the court of Henry VIII, a strange rumor filled all England with surprise. It was reported that the imperialist soldiers had taken Rome by assault, and that some Englishmen were among those who had mounted the breach. One Thomas Cromwell was specially named the man who nearly 20 years before had obtained certain indulgences from Julius II, by offering him some jars of English confectionery. This soldier carried with him the New Testament of Erasmus, and he is said to have learned it by heart during the campaign. Being gay, brave, and intelligent, he entertained, from reading the Gospel and seeing Rome, a great aversion for the policy, superstitions, and disorders of the Popedom. The day of the May 7, 1527 decided the tenor of his life. To destroy the papal power became his dominant idea. On returning to England, he entered the cardinal's household. However, the captive pope and cardinals wrote letters, filled with tears and groans. Full of zeal for the papacy, Wolsey ordered a public fast. "The emperor will never release the pope, unless he be compelled," he told the king. "Sir, God has made you defender of the faith. Save the church and its head." "My lord," answered the king with a smile, "I assure you that this war between the emperor and the pope is not for the faith, but for temporal possessions and dominions." But Wolsey would not be discouraged, and on the 3rd of July, he passed through the streets of London, riding a richly caparisoned mule, and resting his feet on gilt stirrups, while 1,200 gentlemen accompanied him on horseback. He was going to entreat Francis to aid his master in saving Clement VII. He had found no difficulty in prevailing upon Henry. Charles talked of carrying the Pope to Spain, and of permanently establishing the apostolic see in that country. Now, how could they obtain the divorce from a Spanish Pope? During the procession, Wolsey seemed oppressed with grief, and even shed tears, but he soon raised his head and exclaimed, "My heart is inflamed, and I wish that it may be said of the Pope per secula sempiterna. Redite Henrici Octavi Virtut Serena." Desirous of forming a close union between France and England for the accomplishment of his designs, he had cast his eyes on the Princess Renee, daughter of Louis XII, and sister-in-law to Francis I, as the future wife of Henry VIII. Accordingly, the treaty of alliance between the two crowns having been signed at Amiens on the 18th of August, 1527, Francis, with his mother and the cardinal, proceeded to Compiègne, and there Wolsey, styling Charles the most obstinate defender of Lutheranism, promising perpetual conjunction on the one hand, between France and England, and perpetual disjunction on the other. Between England and Germany, demanded Rene's hand for King Henry. Staffilio, Dean of Rota, affirmed that the Pope had been able to permit the marriage between Henry and Catherine only by an error of the keys of St. Peter. This avowal, so remarkable on the part of the Dean of one of the first jurisdictions of Rome, induced Francis' mother to listen favorably to the cardinal's demand. But whether this proposal was displeasing to Renee, who was destined on a future day to profess the pure faith of the gospel with greater earnestness than Margaret of Valois, or whether Francis was not over-anxious for a union that would have given Henry rights over the Duchy of Brittany, she was promised to the son of the Duke of Ferrara. It was a check to the cardinal, but it was his ill fortune to receive one still more severe on his return to England. The daughter of Sir Thomas Boleyn, who had been created Viscount Rochford in 1525, was constantly at court, where she flourished in great estimation and favor, says Cavendish, having always a private indignation against the cardinal for breaking off the pre-contract made between Lord Percy and her, little suspecting that Henry had had any share in it. Her beauty, her graceful carriage, her black hair, oval face, and bright eyes, her sweet voice and singing, her skill and dignity in the dance, her desire to please, which was not entirely devoid of coquetry, her sprightliness, the readiness of her repartees, and above all the amiability of her character, won every heart. She brought to Greenwich and to London the polished manners of the court of Francis I. Every day, it was reported, she invented a new style of dress and set the fashion in England. But to all these qualities, she added modesty, and even imposed it on others by her example. The ladies of the court, who had hitherto adopted a different fashion, says her greatest enemy, covered the neck and bosom as she did, and the malicious, unable to appreciate Anne's motives, ascribed this modesty on the young lady's part to a desire to hide a secret deformity. Numerous admirers once more crowded round Anne Boleyn, and among others, one of the most illustrious noblemen and poets of England, Sir Thomas Wyatt, a follower of Wycliffe. He, however, was not the man destined to replace the son of the Percys. Henry, absorbed in anxiety about his divorce from Catherine, had become low-spirited and melancholy. The laughter, songs, repartees, and beauty of Anne Boleyn struck and captivated him, and his eyes were soon fixed complacently on the young maid of honor. Catherine was more than 40 years old, and it was hardly to be expected that so susceptible a man as Henry would have made, as Job says, a covenant with his eyes not to think upon a maid. Desirous of showing his admiration, he presented Anne, according to usage, with a costly jewel. She accepted and wore it, and continued to dance, laugh, and chatter as before, without attaching particular importance to the royal present. Henry's attentions became more continuous, and he took advantage of a moment when he found Anne alone to declare his sentiments. With mingled emotion and alarm, the young lady fell trembling at the king's feet, and exclaimed, bursting into tears, "I think, most noble and worthy king, your majesty speaks these words in mirth to prove me. I will rather lose my life than my virtue." Henry gracefully replied that he should at least continue to hope. But Anne, rising up, proudly made answer, "I understand not, most mighty king, how you should retain any such hope. Your wife I cannot be, both in respect of mine own unworthiness, and also because you have a queen already. Your mistress I will not be," and kept her word. She continued to show the king, even after this interview, all the respect that was due to him. But on several occasions she proudly, violently even, repelled his advances. In this age of gallantry, we find her resisting for nearly 6 years all the seductions Henry scattered round her. Such an example is not often met with in the history of courts. The books she had read in Margaret's palace gave her a secret strength. All looked upon her with respect, and even the queen treated her with politeness. Catherine showed, however, that she had remarked the king's preference. One day, as she was playing at cards with her maid of honor, while Henry was in the room, and frequently holding the king, she said, "My Lady Anne, you have good hap to stop ever at a king, but you are not like others, you will have all or none," and blushed. From that moment Henry's attentions acquired more importance. She resolved to withdraw from them, and quitted the court with Lady Rochford. The king, who was not accustomed to resistance, was extremely grieved, and having learnt that and would not return to the court either with or without her mother, sent a courier to Hever with a message and a letter for her. If we recollect the manners of the age of Henry VIII, and how far the men, in their relations with the gentler sex, were strangers to that reserve which society now imposes upon them, we cannot but be struck by the king's respectful tone. He writes thus in French, "As the time seems to me very long since I heard from you or concerning your health, the great love I have for you has constrained me to send this bearer to be better informed both of your health and pleasure, particularly because since my last parting with you, I have been told that you have entirely changed the mind in which I left you, and that you either mean to come to court with your mother nor any other way, which report, if true, I cannot enough marvel at, being persuaded in my own mind that I have never committed any offense against you, and it seems hard, in return for the great love I bear you, to be kept at a distance from the person and presence of the woman in the world that I value the most. And if you love me with as much affection as I hope you do, I am sure the distance of our two persons would be equally irksome to you, though this does not belong so much to the mistress as to the servant. Consider well, my mistress, how greatly your absence afflicts me. I hope it is not your will that it should be so, but if I heard for certain that you yourself desired it, I could but mourn my ill fortune, and strive by degrees to abate of my great folly. And so for lack of time I make an end of this rude letter, beseeching you to give the bearer credence in all he will tell you from me. Written by the hand of your entire servant, H.R. The word servant, servitor, employed in this letter explains the sense in which Henry used the word mistress. In the language of chivalry, the latter term expressed a person to whom the lover had surrendered his heart. It would seem that Anne's reply to this letter was the same she had made to the king from the very first, and Cardinal Pole mentions more than once her obstinate refusal of an adulterous love. At last Henry understood Anne's virtue, but he was far from abating of his great folly, as he had promised. That tyrannical selfishness, which the prince often displayed in his life, was shown particularly in his amours. Seeing that he could not attain his end by illegitimate means, he determined to break, as quickly as possible, the bonds which united him to the queen. Anne's virtue was the third cause of Henry's divorce. His resolution being once taken, it must needs be carried out. Henry, having succeeded in bringing Anne back to court, procured a private interview with her, offered her his crown, and seizing her hand, took off one of her rings. But Anne, who would not be the king's mistress, refused also to be his wife. The glory of a crown could not dazzle her, said Wyatt, and two motives in particular counterbalanced all the prospects of greatness which were set before her eyes. The first was her respect for the queen. How could I injure a princess of such great virtue? She exclaimed. The second was the fear that a union with one that was her lord and her king would not give her that freedom of heart and that liberty which she would enjoy by marrying a man of the same rank with herself. Yet the noblemen and ladies of Henry's court whispered to one another that Anne would certainly become Queen of England. Some were tormented by jealousy. Others, her friends, were delighted at the prospect of a rapid advancement. Wolsey's enemies in particular were charmed at the thought of ruining the favorite. It was at the very moment when all these emotions were so variously agitating the court that the cardinal, returning from his embassy to Francis, reappeared in London, where an unexpected blow struck him. Wolsey was expressing his grief to Henry at having failed in obtaining either Margaret or Renee for him, when the king interrupted him. "Console yourself, I shall marry Anne Boleyn." The cardinal remained speechless for a moment. What would become of him, if the king placed the crown of England on the head of the daughter and niece of his greatest enemies? What would become of the church, if a second Anne of Bohemia should ascend the throne? Wolsey threw himself at the feet of his master, and entreated him to renounce so fatal a project. It was then no doubt that he remained, as he afterwards said, an hour or two on his knees before the king in his privy chamber, but without prevailing on Henry to give up his design. Wolsey, persuaded that if he continued openly to oppose Henry's will, he would forever lose his confidence, dissembled his vexation, waiting an opportunity to get rid of this unfortunate rival by some intrigue. He began by writing to the Pope, informing him that a young lady, brought up by the Queen of Navarre, and consequently tainted by the Lutheran heresy, had captivated the king's heart, and from that hour Anne Boleyn became the object of the hatred and calumnies of Rome. But at the same time, to conceal his intentions, Wolsey received Henry at a series of splendid entertainments, at which Anne outshone all the ladies of the court.